Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Ready Steady Read. I'm Chris Kane, and along with James Lavery, this month we've got a sack full of books to talk about. There's the book swap, where James and I each swap books we think the other will enjoy. We're looking at books which are set in alternate realities, and despite the topic, there's not a science fiction one among them. But first, James and I have both strayed out of our comfort zone and read books which are aimed predominantly at women. James, I've been reading Maeve Binchy's latest novel, Heart and Soul. What about you?
And I've been reading Jodi Picoult's latest novel, Second Chance.
I came into this project because you and I, last month, we said, let's read women's literature. And I came into this with a lot of preconceptions about what we were going to experience. And I honestly believed it was going to be single women out trying to get a man and juggle their careers and just have a wonderful time but not feel fulfilled. Or it was going to be some sort of emotional wrench, some sort of terminal illness patient that's just going to die halfway through the book and how their kids are going to cope. That was my preconception about what women's literature is. And it's a preconception that I think is based in what authors and bestseller lists feed me.
I think that's absolutely right. And in fact, the book that I'm reading, the Jodi Picoult book, has almost all of those in it. Although it has to be said that the quality of the writing is a good deal better than we are describing it.
Well, tell me about the book. Jodi Picoult
is a woman's writer of whom I was aware but had never read. And I therefore implored one of my lady friends to send me or give me a book. So I was given one of her more popular ones. In fact, so popular that it's number one in the paperback charts at the minute, My Sister's Keeper. Now, this is a story about a girl who sues her parents over their wish for her to donate her kidney to her sister. The situation is that her sister has been diagnosed with leukemia. They have deliberately conceived this child on the basis that she will give the necessary kidney, the necessary body part, and she sues her parents over that when she gets to a particular age. And it's an interesting book. It deals with a moral question. The quality of writing's tremendous, but by God, it's glacially slow.
What is it about the writing that appeals to you most?
Well, I suppose it's just the use of words. I mean, she does write well. There are two or three types of people whom I admire. If you read Adrian Gill, A.A. Gill as he's known in the Sunday Times, who has a column every week, he writes beautifully, but it's all verbal fireworks. You know, he's all showing off a lot of vast words and encyclopedic knowledge and all of the rest of it. And other people just write a plain story, untrammelled by unnecessary description. This falls somewhere in between those two. There's not so much of the verbal fireworks, but there's a lot of nice storytelling and nice detail in the writing. But as I said, I think it's slow. I think you could tell the same story in half the time.
There's two parts to any good book. There's the writing style and then there's the story itself. Did you find something in the story that appealed to you?
Yes, I did. I mean, I thought this is an important issue. It's one that people would want to read about. It's one that many families are actually going to have to face, particularly as we go through the present set of circumstances where we can manipulate genes within limits to a degree and where people can go out and get IVF and conceive the child that they want, again, to a degree. It's not as simple as that, and I well understand that. So it's an important thing, and it's a good story to tell, but it just tells it slowly. And I keep wanting to poke her and say, move on a bit. You know, come on, tell me the next bit, hurry up.
Is she describing too much? Is it just that it's the minutiae of the lives of the people involved, or is it that she's describing every bit of the courtroom and the hospital room and the kid's bedroom?
It's the issue about feelings. And I shouldn't say this because I know that the women who are listening to this are going to be looking for me and give me a slap round the head with the handbag or any other blunt object that has to be lying.
I think the fact that you think they're going to slap you around the head with a handbag is going to get you a slap round the head with a handbag more so than talking about feelings.
Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. We know about the feelings and we can internalise those and we don't need to have them described to us. They are described beautifully and there are clearly major issues in here and the story is a good story. But I just find it, I really do find it too slow. If I wasn't reading it for this purpose, I would have given up a while ago. I would have said, no, life's too short to be wasting it on these kinds of books. Move along.
I've been reading a paperback too. It's Maeve Binchy's latest in the bestseller list in the paperback chart. It's called Heart and Soul. It's set in Dublin. And it's all about Clara Casey. She's a senior cardiac specialist at a new heart clinic at St Bridget's Hospital. She's got two daughters, Adie and Linda, who are in their 20s. They're having trouble settling down, so that causes problems. And then there's her ex-husband, Alan, who's asking her for a divorce because he wants to marry a much younger woman.
As
so
you do.
We've got the career woman, we've got the mum with grown-up kids, we've got the ex-husband who's a bit of a git. And It reminds me so much of watching a one-hour drama on living TV. And I don't mean that in a nasty way, because there's a lot of stuff like Private Practice and Grey's Anatomy and all of these dramas that are predominantly aimed at women, which I actually don't mind sitting through. If my wife wants to sit and watch them, I can actually sit there quite happily as well. There's enough in there to perk my interest. And this is exactly what this book was to me. It was reading a one-hour drama, but over the whole course of a book. And I was surprised. I actually really enjoyed it. One of the things about Maeve Binchy that I've learned is that if I take the books I normally read, the big action thrillers, they always have moments of high drama, and it's big explosions, or it's car chases, or it's the sort of things that you would expect in a boy's book. What I found interesting about this one is it's the small things in life. It's the cup of tea. It's the little chat with your daughter. It's the things that, as a man, I enjoy in my life that she's writing about in a book. She's
well, I can understand that, but you're not. I think part of what we read books for is escapism. We want to be away from our dull and moribund existence, you know, and therefore you want to think of yourself as James Bond or Dirk Pitt or somebody like that, out on the high seas. So do you not find that an attraction?
I do find that an attraction, but what I wasn't prepared for with Maeve Binchy is that it's offering something else to the armoury of literature that I like to read. Yes, you've got the Clive Cussler, yes, you've got the adventure stories, but this is, it's ordinary people doing pretty ordinary things, but it's told in quite a compelling way. It's almost like having your friends round on a Sunday afternoon. They haven't done anything overly exciting in the last week since you saw them last, but you still enjoy hearing about what they've done.
Well, that's right.
This is what this book was.
It's a nice conversation. I hadn't thought of the Jodi Picoult book like that, and when I'll go back and have another look at it in those terms.
It's time for tonight's book swap. That's where James and I swap a book that we think the other will enjoy. But before we get to this month's swap, let's talk about what we thought of last month's swap. Now, James, you gave me Memoirs of an Irish RM, and I gave you Roundabouts of Great Britain. We'll start with mine first. What did you think of Roundabouts? Because you were quite worried about this.
I was annoyed, to say the least, about it, I have to say. And what I liked about it was very little, other than it's the kind of book that you would keep in the downstairs loo, isn't it? That you would sit and flick through for no apparent reason. And you also give me boring postcards, which is equally strange. But what happened was that I left these books in the back of my car. My grandchildren got in, and they began to look through them. And because there's nothing to read in them, they're only pictures and they can't read anyway, they thought they were wonderful. And there was fights over them. No, give me that one, give me that one. And I had one particular occasion to stop the car and stop them coming to blows over who was getting roundabouts and who was getting boring postcards.
It doesn't always have to be about literature. Books can do a lot of things, but if they make you talk, if they start a conversation, they've done one of the big things.
Now, I gave you one of my favourite books of all time, Memoirs of an Irish RM, an Irish resident magistrate. What did you think of that?
The thing I liked about this book is it was a collection of short stories, so you didn't have to read it in one go. You could pick it up almost like you would do with boring postcards. You could pick it up and read a story at a time. The magistrate is quite a good character as
well.
He's
a great character.
And Slipper is the crook.
Absolutely. It used to be said that Joxer in Juno and the Peacock was the kind of greatest character in Irish literature, but I think Slipper is by far and away the greatest character. If you remember, there was a BBC adaptation of this book a few years ago, and Peter Bowles played the resident magistrate, and he's just, you know, the man kind of dumped into this milieu, and everybody's kind of taken a hand out of him, with no great malice involved until they get to know him. But Slipper's always at the heart of that trouble, you know. It's always either drunk or thieving or up to no good. And I think he's a wonderful character.
It had that sort of quaint Irish niceness about it. You know, we see it in a lot of films and a lot of books, which is there's the drunk. There's so many stereotypical characters, but they're harmless.
That's right. There is an issue about not being malicious and all of this. And
if you came across these characters in Glasgow, you'd run away. But because they've got that Irish charm about them, you don't mind them quite
as much. It's what William Butler Yeats used to call the indomitable Irishry. And it is a bit stage Irish, but it's funny and amusing. And I just love it. I could come back to it any time.
This month, I have got for you The Undercover Economist. What do you know about economics?
Very little, it has to be said. Like most of the bankers of our nation.
Well, I'm exactly the same. But it's of course, one of the biggest things that affect our daily lives. But as soon as you say economics, you think textbooks and you think, oh, this is going to be horrible. But Tim Hartford has done something which I think is very clever. He's taken what's quite a boring subject and he's presented it in a way that appeals to you and I. And it'll give you a very good grounding in the basics of economics, but it's told in a way which is accessible to all of us. It asks the question, or it tries to answer the question, why is there a Starbucks in every corner?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's putting economics into the terms that we can understand. How supermarkets get the most money out of you. Why do traffic jams exist?
I remember reading Will Hutton a little while ago. He was the editor of The Guardian, I think, at the time. And he's an economist to trade, and he was again talking about stuff like this, the unexpected consequence of particular actions, you know. And I think, therefore, I'm actually quite looking forward to reading this. It's not one I would pick up, but I look forward to it.
It's an American book, so it's got an American slant. But it tries to answer questions like, why has China grown so quickly? Why is Africa quite so poor? And towards the end of the book, it almost becomes like a travel book, because mm-hmm. the author's talking about so many different things around the world. But if you want to understand economics, if you want a basic understanding of economics that's as far away from a textbook as you can get, then I'm recommending Tim Hartford, The Undercover Economist. So
very good. Well, thank you very much for that.
As tell I said, me how you get on.
I've got a book for you called Ratcatcher by a man called James McGee. Now, this is just a straightforward thriller set in Georgian times. The guy is a Bow Street runner, the precursor to the police who came along after Sir Robert Peel, which is why they're all called Bobbies, of course. And what I liked about this was that some years ago there were a series of books about a similar character called Blackstone, which, contrary to what we were saying earlier about men's books and women's books, my wife and I used to read with some glee and swap back and forth and really liked a lot. And this is obviously someone writing in a similar vein. See what you think about it. It's fairly straightforward. It's nothing complex or difficult. It's just a kind of detective story, if you want to call it that, or a thriller set in Georgian times, and I think you'll like it.
It's time for I Write, now that part of the programme where we look at technology. Have you got a book in you, James? You ever wanted to write a book?
I always think I do have a book in me, but I need to apply my rear end to the chair and my pen to the paper.
Well, if you have got a book in you, if you've written your book, then blurb.com is a bit of free software you can get that will help you lay it out. And then you can upload it to blurb.com and the site will make it into a real paperback novel and then you can get them printed, starting at a fiver.
I think that's quite a good idea because there used to be a lot of vanity publishers out there. You paid them for publishing your book rather than the other way around. But at least if you had something in your hand, you could pass it around to a few people and get some comments on it and all the rest of it. I think that would be a good idea.
So if you've got your book half written and you think it's time to start making it look like a real paperback, blurb.com.
Let me come in and talk to you then about another website which does a similar sort of thing. And this one is called Authonomy.com. It's been set up by HarperCollins. And the process is that if you have written your book, you can then upload it to this site and let other people read it for free. And obviously, if it gets a lot of hits on it and people like it and make decent comments about it, then there is always a chance, I think, that HarperCollins might take it up and then you would actually get published. And that's the biggest hurdle. It's getting past the slush pile, getting yourself an agent, doing all of that work. So I think this is a really good way forward. I'm going to have a go at Authonomy.com.
Rarebookroom.org. Have you ever wanted to own a rare first edition?
No, I haven't.
The Gutenberg Bible, perchance?
No. Just decidedly not the Gutenberg Bible. I would be afraid. I would be worried that the kids would get it and put crayons onto it or something, you know?
That would just add character to it. Well, rarebookroom.org is 400 priceless literary treasures, first editions, like a first edition Shakespeare, that have been scanned in ultra-high resolution and they're yours to look at online. So you might never own a first edition Shakespeare, but at least you know what one looks like in case you come across it at the jumble sale.
Well, I think that would be a very good thing. And actually, I would love that, and I will go away and have a good look at that.
Authors have an amazing imagination. It's one of the prerequisites you need to do the job. Many of them can imagine fantastic worlds full of wizards and warlocks. Think of J.K. Rowling. Many of them can imagine wonderful things that happen with normal people in ordinary situations and make them readable and exciting to all of us. Whatever authors do, if they do it well, they captivate us. But what we're going to talk about now is something that authors do which we all wonder. It starts in the pub and it goes like this. I wonder what would have happened if. Books that are set in a world which is not quite our own. Something has happened in the past that's different. And the one that I've been reading that you recommended to me, James, is Len Deighton's SSGB. And this is a book that's imagined that the Germans had won the Second World War in 1940. It's a book I've just read, but it's a book you read years ago.
It is. I loved this book. I thought it was absolutely marvellous. And what I liked about it was that they immersed you again in the culture of the time. It wasn't so much an issue about what the Germans would be up to. You know, they were one clear and important issue in all of this. But it was also about technology of the time. You know, no such thing as a mobile phone. Not much in the way of phones. No computers, of course. Typewriters. All sorts of stuff that you just, that I grew up with, but I've now forgotten because I'm used to where we are now.
The central character is called Harry Archer, or Superintendent Harry Archer. He works for Scotland Yard in 1941. He is a murder detective, and he's been doing it all of his life. The only difference is 9 months ago, the Germans invaded his country and captured it. But at the heart of this book is a murder investigation. Something has happened, and he has to use his policeman's hat and go in and work it out. But as opposed to having that jolly chief superintendent or chief constable, he's got SS Offenstaffen Hufen, Hufen, Mufen, Mufen de Hufer.
Obergruppenführer.
That's him, yes, the German guy sitting in the office upstairs. The world that this book is set in is London 9 months after the Germans have won the war. So it's all different. It's much more of a police state.
Very much so. And I think he captures that very well. We still have situations where we have the London fog going on. There are issues about the technology set of the times. And the interesting thing is that almost from the beginning, we kind of guess where the problem is or what the issue is here in terms of it's an actual debate about the calculations required to make an atomic bomb. But they don't know that. They don't even know about radiation poisoning.
And I wonder, this book was written in the 60s. This is when radiation poisoning and all sorts of problems associated with atomic weapons was at the forefront of everyone's mind. I mean, you lived through the 60s, James. Everyone thought you were going to die in a horrible nuclear explosion. This book, to an extent, taps into that fear of radiation and nuclear weapons, but it also taps into the fact that when it was written, it's only 20 years since the war had finished.
I think that's the important point. Lots of people there who would still remember the circumstances of the war and how close we came to defeat. I mean, if it hadn't been for the intervention of the Americans, much as it pains me to say it, you know, we would now all be speaking German.
What I particularly liked about the way the story was told is that the invasion and subsequent occupation of Britain was almost secondary to the police investigation, in that within the book they kept throwing little facts in about what had happened in the war, but they didn't talk about it. It was Superintendent Archer when he saw the new souvenirs that were being sold in London. It was little tower bridges with swastikas painted on them. The tourism issue also cropped up when Harry mentioned that one of the other souvenirs you could get in this post-war London was a real piece of the Elgin marbles, lifted from the rubble of the British Museum, which had been bombed in the final days of the war. And that's how they presented it, and it was very, very good. There's some interesting supporting characters in this, in that Archer's sidekick is a sergeant in the police who's been there for 100 years, and he's got that Cockney way of doing things. There's the new German boss that's been parachuted into the police force, who appears like a sort of German buffoon. You can see him with his feathers and his hunting gears in the Bavarian Alps, but he's a little bit more savvy than he lets on. There's the SS yes. major that's parachuted in from Berlin that you can tell is quite evil, and there's well-rounded characters as well as a well-rounded story, and I was quite surprised at how engrossing this book became quite quickly. Len Dayton's SSGB. It's long been out of print, but it's not difficult to get hold of a copy. You will find it on Amazon, on Abe Books, and it'll only cost you a couple of pounds, and I would very much recommend that you go out and get that. James, what other books have been set in an alternate history, and is it the case, did you find, as I did when I was doing my research on this, that the alternate histories always seem to be an alternate Second World War history?
Well, some of them did. I think that's absolutely right, although there are two or three that are very much definitely not the case. For example, there is Robert Harris's famous book Fatherland, which again is a detective story set in Germany in this particular case. And again, the story there, and this is one of the issues that Len Dighton doesn't address in his book about the Holocaust. What's happening in Robert Harris's book is that Germany again has won the war. We are all living in Greater Germany, and there's an issue about hiding what happened with the Holocaust and trying to make sure that Americans in particular, where there is some hope of rapprochement, don't find out about that.
The thing about Fatherland, though, is it's a German army officer. This is set in the 60s, mm-hmm. but it's still a Nazi officer
uncovering the Holocaust. And it throws a sort of interesting dynamic onto the book in that it's almost the Nazi Party discovering one of its own hidden horrors from the past. And I think the thing I didn't like about Fatherland is it sort of throws up questions, which is the main character actually quite a nice guy because he's trying to uncover a wrong and deal with it. But he's still, fundamentally, in the Nazi Party.
But again, I think that has more resonance for us in the modern age than, for example, the Holocaust did. I mean, people were aware of the Holocaust, you know, in 1960, 1970, but it has much more resonance for us now, particularly with all of the issues that are going on in the Middle East and all of the rest of it.
Need to say hello to Ron, who sent us an email this month to say, when you're talking about this, you have to mention Philip Roth's The Plot Against America. Now, I hadn't read this one, but you went, I know that one. And this is a presidential election that turns out differently.
That's right. This is a set of circumstances where Lindbergh, who was the guy who flew across the Atlantic and also the guy whose children were kidnapped by Loeb and Lowe, won the election on the back, presumably, of his fame, first of all, as an aeronaut.
He defeats President Roosevelt.
And you get a very different America. And basically what you get is an America which is, I suppose, the America of the 30s brought up to date with modern technology, so that you still have a lot of very bad attitudes in terms of anti-Semitism, racism, all that kind of thing is still deeply embedded within the American culture. And in fact, it was deeply embedded within the American culture up till about 1960, 1965, and it was more Lyndon Johnson than President Kennedy who managed to eventually begin the process that would largely eradicate it. It's still there, I suppose, but in industrial terms, in organisational terms, it no longer exists and can't exist. And that's an interesting book. Philip Roth wrote that, and it's more literary fiction than a thriller or a story, but nonetheless well worth reading.
We've got Len Dayton, SSGB, and Robert Harris, Fatherland, which all deal with the Germans winning the war. Philip Roth, The Plot Against America, which deals with Charles Lindbergh beating Roosevelt in a fictional presidential election. Have you found anything else that's not quite so mired up in the events of the Second World War?
There are literally dozens of books out there and dozens of series of books out there dealing with this kind of alternative history. The one that I like best is a guy called S.M. Sterling, who has written a series. There are actually three books, but they've been republished and put together in one large book called The Domination of the Draka. Now, what he imagines is a world in which the Crown Colony of South Africa, what is now the Republic of South Africa, which in those days was called Drakia because it had been founded by Sir Francis Drake, becomes a world power, eventually almost the opposite of America. On one hand, you have the Confederation of States, which is essentially America and the Western world, and on the other hand, you have the Draka, who are horrible Nazis to the ninth degree, absolutely horrible. This is three thrillers, deeply, deeply rich in terms of their writing. It doesn't go into a lot of descriptions about the culture of the Draka, but you get it all as background to the story from time to time. I would thoroughly recommend them to anybody.
So this is the South Africans become, what, the USSR?
Well, they become effectively the Nazis by another name. You know, the South Africans are, first of all, take over Africa. The interesting point which he places all this is that he talks about a Major Robert Ferguson, who was a real historical figure and who was the guy who invented the first breech-loading rifle. Now, as it happened, Robert Ferguson was killed in the American Civil War, and in any event, he was having considerable difficulty convincing people of the necessity of having a breech-loading rifle when people still liked to stick to muskets. But the Drake colony took over this guy, took over the breech-loading rifle, and used that rifle to dominate the greater part of Africa, opening up Africa and all its richness to use by them. They turned into complete slavers. Eventually, they conquer half the world. So on one side, you've got America and its allies, and on the other side, you've got these guys.
So it's S.M. Sterling, The Domination of the Draka.
S.M. Sterling, The Domination of the Draka. Wonderful
is that
set
an
of
old
books.
Book?
Relatively, about 10 or 15 years, but it started off as three books, but look out for S.M. Sterling, and if you see a thing called Marching Through Georgia, for example, that's the first book in the series, and you'll easily pick up the others as well.
One more to finish off, Harry Turtledove, tell me about his books.
This is this whole issue of alternative history. He's written a whole series of books in which the American Civil War never quite came to an end. The North did not win. In effect, the North doesn't take the South over, doesn't really lock it tight into what is now the USA, and therefore the Civil War breaks out every 30 or 40 years or so. And again, in this, Harry Turtledove addresses the whole issue of the Holocaust, because what he describes, almost again as a background to one of his stories, is a set of circumstances where they set up camps to exterminate black people as opposed to exterminating Jews. It's not as detailed and not as richly described as S.M. Sterling's stuff, but great stories, crackingly well written, and again, a good recommendation.
Time for this month's Bits and Pieces, and we've had so many good comments about Bits and Pieces, we've made it Bits and Pieces and a few extra bits as well. We really need a catchy name for this. Michael Jackson, of course, died last month, and it captured the attention of the world in a way that I can't remember since Princess Diana died, and I'm a little bit reticent to put Michael Jackson and Princess Diana in the same breath,
in
terms of the coverage that they got. But on the back of that, I was very, very intrigued to see that HarperCollins were one of 15 publishers racing to get the first commemorative biography onto the shelves. How quickly do you think, James, you can take a book from concept to being in the shelves?
I would have needed about 3 or 4 weeks even to write something like that, and it wouldn't be good at the end of that.
Well, they did it in a fortnight. What HarperCollins had is a biography of Michael Jackson that was last updated 5 years ago. So the minute he died, they hired a freelance author, locked him in a room for 2 days and told him to write 10,000 words, which was the last 5 years of his life. They then took it to the typesetters, then took it to the printers and the designers, and in 2 weeks, they got 110,000 copies of this thing printed and distributed to be the first onto the shelves. And I'm staggered at what you can do.
I found a couple of interesting things. And one is because I want to tell you about, simply because it's the recent anniversary of the moon landings. And there's a book called Bioastronautics. Now, what it is really a series of charts as to what might happen to the human body in space, done at the time of the moon shots away back in 1970. And it's just funny. I mean, you have to look for the humour in it, because basically you've got a whole series of essentially medical charts. You will find it on Flickr, or you will find it on a web log, which I've spoken to you about before, boingboing.net. And, you know, 5 minutes is enough, and plenty of it. But just because of the time that's in it, because we're hearing about Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and all the rest of it, there were lots of people sitting down trying to figure out what the effect space would have on your body, what would happen if you crashed, all these sorts of things. And it's all set out in this book called Bioastronautics.
What words make you mad, James?
Too many. I've turned into a grumpy old man.
Don't give me the swear words, because this is Ledbury Poetry Festival asked poets to tell them what words they hated and why.
Well, tell us then. Tell us. Don't hold back.
Well, they didn't like clichés, for a start. So all clichés that they didn't use. Americanisms. Math.
Yes.
It's time for my math class. That annoys me as well.
Sums we used to call that, but never mind.
Colloquialisms. Like, for when you're quoting. Like, quoting.
Yes. Yeah,
that's like, good.
Are you not allowed to, like, hold your two hands up and do those little quotation marks?
Yeah, so they didn't like. Political correctness. Words like chairperson.
Yeah. We used to say...
Lollipop person.
Well, we always just said lollipop man, even if it was a lollipop lady. But when I was in local government, we said chair, which I think is even worse.
They didn't like nouns used as verbs.
Right.
To critique.
No.
Or a critique, sorry.
Yeah.
That's a critique of something.
Right. Well, that's an Americanism, isn't it? Only American academics would do things like that.
And also, this was taken up on one of the newspaper websites. It was the Guardian, and they asked their readers to come up with words that they didn't like. Are you ready for the list?
Go ahead.
Start cringing. This is words that Guardian readers didn't like seeing in books: crotch, sack, gusset, nappy, gutted, rectum, gash, pustule, spatula, masticate.
I wonder what they were
boobs,
mixing that up with.
Feisty, veggie, cookie, pasty, pamphlet, spouse, and ironically, poet.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's it. So a list of words that poets don't like. That's another bits and pieces from me. Have you got anything else?
Frank McCourt has died. Now, people will remember Frank McCourt as being the author of Angela's Ashes, which I just think was an absolutely fantastic book. I read it, thank goodness, on a beach in Ibiza, well, near a swimming pool in Ibiza, because I wouldn't like to have read it on a rainy day. It was not a cheery book at all, but beautifully written, terribly interesting. And poor Frank McCourt has died, 78 years old, suffering from melanoma and also suffering from meningitis. And I'm sorry to see the back of him. He was a wonderful writer.
That's Bits and Pieces this month, and that's the end of this month's programme. We hope we've given you lots of ideas of books to read. Remember, if you, though, would like to suggest a book for us to read in a future programme, you can get in touch. Our email address is books@podcastplace.co.uk. And remember, the next episode of Ready, Steady, Read will be available from this website on the 1st of September. Until then, goodbye.